This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Videos go viral on YouTube all the time. We've seen links to clips of babies dancing or pandas sneezing. But what happens when viral videos are as serious as life and death? Kony 2012 is a video campaign released by a nonprofit organization called Invisible Children. It's based in San Diego. The short film aims to raise awareness about a man named Joseph Kony, who was responsible for kidnapping countless children in northern Uganda and other areas in Central Africa for use in his rebel army. The film is partly framed as a conversation between Invisible Children's founder, Jason Russell, and his son. Near the beginning of the film, Russell explains why he feels his young son should know about Joseph Kony.
He was born into a pretty complicated world. And as a dad, I want him to grow up in a better world than I did. And because of the course of events in my life, I see a way to get there. It has become my job.
The video is less than a month old. It has already reached over 100 million views. Many people are extremely moved by the video, which asks them to wear wristbands and poster their town with pictures of Joseph Kony until he is a household name. But the film has also attracted critics. Some say Jason Russell has told the story in a way that leaves Ugandans themselves voiceless. Others say the film presents a simplistic view of a complex issue. Michael Palm is an assistant professor of communication studies in the Concentration of Media Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Sophia Swimelar is an assistant professor of political science and coordinator of nonviolent studies program at Elon University, and both are my guests today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Also, we're taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org. Are you one of the 100 million who have seen the Kony 12 video? What did you think? Have your ideas about it changed? Give us a call, 877-962-9862. Michael Palm, for the people who haven't seen this video, give us a brief summary of what goes on.
Well, I thought your introduction to the film was very apt and appropriate because while it's titled Kony 2012 and does claim that its primary ambition is to make Joseph Kony a star, a celebrity on the same level as George Clooney or some of the other celebrity activists that Invisible Children has recruited to help in their campaign, it really is, at its heart, a story about a father and a son. And they're both very white, they're both very winsome, and the video, from my perspective, is largely, if not primarily, about their reaction to learning about Joseph Kony, the Lord's Resistance Army, and how they respond emotionally and what they feel they can do about it moving forward.
LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, a vicious militia that has terrorized. It's not operating now so much in northern Uganda, but was for a while. Responsible for thousands and thousands of deaths, child soldiers, mutilations, rape. It was a vicious campaign. And part of the film at some point eventually does get to that. What are the images? What makes this film so compelling, do you think?
I think the images, as you said, and also the way that they're edited and put together, some of the pacing, some of the use of social media, The Facebook page is used, for example, to both go back through Jason Russell's timeline and explain how he became aware of the story and befriended one child soldier in particular. And then also the Facebook page is used to kind of accumulate the story and kind of, you know, used to demonstrate how Invisible Children is mobilizing awareness and support for the Kony 2012 campaign.
And there are images of people who have been victimized by the Lord's Resistance Army and child soldiers like Jacob, the one who Jason met and was the impetus behind this film. Let's hear this clip of Jason Russell explaining Joseph Kony's crimes to his 5-year-old son, Gavin.
This is the guy, Joseph Kony.
He's the bad guy?
Yeah. Who's this?
Jacob.
Joseph Kony, he has an army, okay? And what he does is he takes children and he gives them a gun to shoot and he makes them shoot and kill other people.
But they're not going to do what he says because they're nice guys, right?
Yeah, they don't want to do what he says, but he forces them to do bad things.
Here we go. Sophia Swimelar, what do you make of the criticisms that this film is seems to be more about Jason and his son than about the LRA or the trauma in northern Uganda?
Well, I think those criticisms are accurate. If you look at the first few minutes and the last few minutes of the video, which in any kind of piece of video, those are kind of important pieces, and they have nothing to do with Ugandan children or Joseph Kony. They have to do with Jason and his son, and they really have to do with the audience. So it's not just sort of self-congratulatory toward Jason and his son, but the audience is really the most important thing, and that's primarily young, white, middle-class students who are seen in these very, very large collectives with very hip music behind them. It's a very emotional scene that, of course, wants to draw you in and makes you want to be part of that collective and that movement. And I think that's why it is so powerful that it's speaking to you. I mean, some of the quotes, for example, it said, you know, you or we can change the course of human history, right? I mean, this is really powerful language, again, that focuses on how the audience is going to feel better about themselves for saving the world and doing good. And that could lead to some positive ends that we could talk about later, but it also has some problems in focusing on the savior, so to speak, from the West of African children, as opposed to empowering, as you mentioned earlier, empowering Africans themselves or Ugandans themselves to talk about reconciliation or catching Kony.
Michael?
Yeah, 2 points about the narrative devices of the film. One, I think the clip that you played illustrates perfectly, is that a lot of the immediate reaction and a lot of the anger about the film was that it was literally boiled down to the level that a 5-year-old can understand, and that a very deeply historical and complicated situation was boiled down to nice guys and bad guys, or you know, into good and evil. And I think that is an important place to start. The other thing that struck me about the framing of the story is when Russell says at least once, this is also a story about you, meaning us, the viewers, the people that Sophia was referring to, but that the way that the story is about us is only from here moving forward, what we can do by wearing the wristband, buying the action kit, participating in the 420 mobilization with no acknowledgement or consideration of the way that this story, as it's come to pass, is also about us in terms of our own complicity in some of the broader geopolitics that have led to this situation in Uganda and throughout Central Africa.
It's a story that goes back to 1985. We're going to go into some detail about the LRA as the program continues, but it's a long and a complex story, and as you say, has its roots in colonialism. But look, what about this business of appealing to me, the white audience here in the United States? Yeah, appeal to me, because I'm the one who has to get motivated. I'm the one who's going to help find this guy, take him off the streets, and end this violence now in Central Africa as he's moved from northern Uganda. Of course you want to appeal to me. How else are you going to get me to enter this fight?
Well, I agree that that's part of the power and the genius of the film, right? I mean, if you study NGO movements and in human rights movements, that's what they're about, right? You have to get people interested. And if you some people have trouble with the means of getting people interested, but others look at the ends and say, well, if it takes an emotional story that makes you connect to Jacob and to Gavin and to Jason and all of those people, then so be it, right? If that's going to cause you to contact your congressperson, to write letters, to go to the library, to go online and learn more about these things. But it does overhype the ability of a general American young person to catch Joseph Kony, even if you had hundreds of millions of people contacting Congress, and maybe we'll get to that later, that the goal of actually catching him, is that a feasible goal that students or young people here can help accomplish through lobbying their senators? And I'm skeptical of that part, I guess.
What are some of the effects, do you think, of leaving out that other part of the story? First of all, the efforts that are underway in Uganda, so leaving out those voices and also making it seem like we're the saviors that can move in and solve this African problem, which apparently they can't settle themselves. What are some of the subtle but perhaps profound impacts of that kind of a narrative?
Well, I think that kind of narrative ignores the fact that that region is very highly militarized. And the video, in a sense, calls for more of that. And I think that kind of effect doesn't ask you to think about that. It doesn't ask you to think about, do we want to provoke more military action in a region that is already so violent? It doesn't talk about peace treaties and reconciliation and things like that. It also has the effect I said earlier of making people sort of believe and hope that they can solve this problem. And it also leads to the effect of the assumption that if we catch Kony, everything is going to be okay. And that, I think, is one of the worst parts of the film, is that that arrest will change everything, right? Yeah. And we know that the socioeconomic complexities of the region are not going to be solved by one person being in prison. I mean, like, I work on the Balkans, and there's a lot of research done about, you know, when we had Milosevic and other war criminals put away. And I've asked victims in that area how they feel about that. Yeah, sure, they feel better. But does that help them in their daily life, you know, with education and the economy and jobs? It doesn't. And that's what I'm worried about with this video, is it focuses it on this one person and doesn't look at the complexity of what's going on there, and doesn't look at how we are involved in that, right? How former colonial powers in the United States and structural issues help create the problems that Africa's dealing with. It's
well, simplified. And particularly most of our digital devices that are using conflict minerals that are mined from that very part of the
exactly.
world. And every time we buy a new iPhone, we're placing a demand on those countries and the still colonial powers that and corporations, frankly, that run them. So if you don't know that, then when you're on your iPhone saying, let's catch Kony, you realize, oh, gee, I'm part of the problem, aren't I? Or you don't realize because it's not in the film.
That's one of the most chilling aspects of it to me, was the solution being called for was essentially having Facebook Nation mobilized calling for U.S. military intervention in a poverty-stricken, mineral-rich region of Africa, which seems like a neoliberal fantasy in terms of mobilizing some of the consumer technology that you mentioned, Frank.
Well, I want to take a break right here, and we're going to come back talking about the film Kony 2012, a viral video. My guest, Michael Palm, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and also with us, Sophia Swimlar, an Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elon. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of the war, talk with a student at Elon who is from Uganda, and taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking about Kony 2012, a video that went viral, 100 million views so far. It's about finding and arresting Ugandan warlord Joseph Kony. Michael Palm is with us. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Sophia Swimlar is an assistant professor of political science at Elon University. I'm joined now by Jan Herman, the program coordinator of the Center for Reconciliation at Duke's Divinity School. And Michael Kayemba is an Ugandan student at UNC Chapel Hill. And I want to welcome both of you to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm taking your phone calls and emails at 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Have you seen this video? What did you think? Did you hear the controversy? Has any of that changed your mind about the film? 877-962-9862. Many Ugandans felt hurt by this video. As we've said earlier in the program, Ugandan voices were captured by Al Jazeera, critical of this video.
It would have been better if initially people in the north looked through and say, we agree to that, it would make sense. And if we had not brought it down here, no one would bring it and they would be completely excluded.
If people in those countries care about us, they will not wear T-shirts with pictures of Joseph Kony for any reason. That would celebrate our suffering.
There are some kind of people, there are some kind of NGO who are trying to mobilize funds using the atrocities committed in northern Uganda.
We wanted to see how our local people were killed.
Correct.
So these are all white men. These are feelings different from northern Uganda.
Michael Kayemba, where are you from in Uganda? You're not from northern Uganda, where a lot of this happened, right?
No, I'm not.
Where are you from?
I'm from the central part of Uganda.
You've seen this film?
Yes, I have.
What was your reaction to it?
My gut reaction was that if, saving for all the inconsistencies, all the assumptions and all the problems that the movie has, which I could tear apart from the very first minute to the last, if anything, in terms of their message and what they are trying to accomplish, the least I could say is the message was incomplete, and even their campaign that they are trying to achieve, at the very least, is incomplete.
What got left out?
I feel that in terms of their target audience to begin with, they missed out a very, very crucial, important part of the general conflict, that is the youth of the affected countries, the youth in Uganda, the youth in Central African Republic, the youth in DRC, the youth in Southern Sudan. So if at all this even had a shot at all at being successful, my feeling was that the youth in these countries had to be as fired up about the issue as the SLAG activists seem to be fired up about it.
I want to take a phone call right now. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. Matt is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering, in an instance like this, is there really such a thing as bad publicity? If the goal is to get Kony's name out there and to expose some of his crimes, even if there was kind of more of a humanist message that can kind of relate to more Americans at the beginning and the end of the video, I guess my question is that such a bad thing?
Right.
And also kind of a follow-up, how would the guest of the show maybe have handled the video a little bit differently? How would they have done it differently?
All right. Well, thanks, Matt. We may have gotten part of that answer from Michael Kiyumba, but let me start with you in terms of, is any news bad news when it comes to drumming up some effort to stop this guy?
I think that's true, and I'm going to make use of the words of a Nigerian novelist called Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And at some point she was speaking at the TED conference and she said this: power is not just the ability to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. And I feel that this is the epitome of what this video did. It took away all the agency of not only Northern Ugandans, but Ugandans and East Africans, and by extension, most Africans, by telling just a single part of its story, of their story.
Well, let me ask you to step back a little bit. The Kony 2012 video starts in the middle of a conflict, I suppose toward the end of a conflict, but it did begin many, many years ago. Give us a brief history of this rebel group, the Lord's Resistance Army.
Thank you. I'd be glad to. The Lord's Resistance Army was one of many militias and resistance groups that formed in 1985, 1986, during the period when the current government of Uganda, itself a rebel group, took power violently in Uganda and began to consolidate its power by moving into the north. A great number of atrocities were committed by now President Museveni's troops. And in response, there were many groups that formed. In the years following that, the government of Uganda signed peace agreements with almost all of those. The one that they neglected, partly because they thought it was too unimportant to matter, was Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army. And so that group continued to fight and to destabilize the North during a time when the rest of Uganda was trying very hard to recover economically from years of civil war. And the North continued to be unstable, unable to grow. There was a concerted military effort in the early 90s, and it was in response to that that the Lord's Resistance Army became a much more vicious militia and began to turn against its own people and to commit the kinds of things that the video has made people famous for.
You have done aid work in that part of the world, is that right?
Yes, I served with Mennonite Central Committee, a faith-based organization that's been in Uganda since 1979. I was there 2004 to 2010, so I have been among night commuters described and shown in the video, and worked with a number of Ugandan organizations which have been working through peaceful means, advocating a nonviolent resolution to the conflict, because, of course, it's not just about ending the violence. It's about recovering from the years of enforced refugee lives and destruction of families.
That's one of the things that's left out of the video, is how much is already going on in Uganda in general, northern Uganda in particular, to help heal, not just to get Kony, but to help recover. Tell us about some of those efforts.
I'd be glad to. Since 1998, religious leadership in northern Uganda came together, the Archbishop of the Catholic Church, several bishops of Anglican diocese, Sheikh Musa Khalil, the Qadi of northern Uganda Muslim groups, and an Orthodox, came together to advocate for a negotiated end to this conflict. They formed the Acholi Religious Leaders Peace Initiative. They were almost successful several times in bringing this group from the bush, from without any presence in normal society, and the government together. And each time, 2002, 2004, 2006, each time as the agreement came close, another military thrust from the government of Uganda would undo those efforts.
But they are going on. They weren't reflected in the film, and it's a different approach. And I wonder, Michael Kayemba, there's an underlying assumption in this film that the ordinary American viewer might not notice because it's the ground we walk on. Somebody has done a bad thing. Catch them and punish them. That's how we do things here. That's not always, in terms of the way it reflects culture in that region, does it do it well? It seems to me that there are other approaches to these kinds of problems that in Uganda might run afoul or conflict with the cultural assumptions in this film.
Yes and no. Just to begin with, if Kony is to be caught right now, he will most likely end up at the ICC. If you're to ask me,
the International Criminal Court,
or like many people have suggested a better name, the African International Criminal Court, more like. And personally, I would not be comfortable with Kony being tried at the ICC. To begin with, I feel like the process of justice is part of the healing process that people go through, and it is important. And for Kony to be taken away at the ICC, which many countries are not seeking to resolve, I won't make names, but it will take away from the people's healing process who would have gone to the courtroom and seen Kony there, made testimonies. Yes, they could be flown to The Hague, but you're not going to fly 100,000 people to The Hague. Yet if Kony is tried in northern Uganda, people make arguments that our justice structures are not good, but they are there. That is a good thing that they are there. So they could be augmented, they could be made better, and I believe that northern Ugandans would benefit from Kony being tried in northern Uganda. Mm-hmm. And secondly, about the cultural conflicts with a punitive justice system, in northern Uganda, like my colleague here already said, there have already been efforts to reconcile, brought about by religious leaders. And I think one of those is called Mata Oput. It is a very common one among the Acholi people. And right now is being applied to the child soldiers too. So it's done I think the most good example would be in a focus group where they bring out a child soldier, members of the community, members of the bereaved family, community leaders and religious leaders. And it's very much a conversation, first of all, to establish facts, to hear stories from the rebels' side as to their motivations, stories from the community about how they were affected. It's very much an inclusive process. Most people are critics of it because they think it does not serve justice. No. Rebels thereafter do serve a punitive term, either within the community where they're supposed to help the community grow and rebuild and rehabilitate. And I feel this one is a much more value best system.
But in the process you described, the people who are affected are the ones who maintain control of the process rather than give the process and give the case to the state, at which point we're once again, our story was taken away.
Or not even just the state, but even outside players.
So let me ask you, Michael Palm, just in terms of the way the film is constructed, am I right? There's an underlying assumption here that that going out and getting them is the only way to go. There's no reflection of any of this other possible process. And that's a kind of subtle message in the film that, of course, you wouldn't get if you didn't know there are other ways of doing things.
Yes. And going back to the caller's question about thinking about alternative ways to do this, I think Jan and Michael already hit on two important ones in terms of greater contextualization and a more prominent place for Ugandan citizens in the construction of the narrative. And to reiterate a third, I think, would be to an alternative would have been to implicate the us in this that you alluded to at the beginning of the show, not only in having a moral obligation to act on this because evil exists out in the world, but because we are implicated in the conditions that led to the situation in the first place. And I think the last thing I think any of us want to do is diminish or disparage an emotional reaction that a viewer of the video might have, especially considering that almost exclusively the people who brought this video to my attention were students, students of mine or college students that I know. But I also think that it's probably wise to resist the PR maxim in this context that all publicity is good publicity. And I've seen several criticisms and several responses to the video call for an application of the Hippocratic Oath to both international aid and to media activism and to do no additional harm. Exactly. And so I think that might provide an alternative perspective that the caller was asking for.
Sophia?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll add to that, and also to the caller. In a way, I do agree with the caller that, that I have a colleague, for example, who has a daughter, I think, who's 14, who watched the video, and she said something like, you know, if it gets a young person at this age to just think about people in the rest of the world, to not just think about shopping or themselves for a little while, to think about wider humanity, then maybe later, as they get older and they go to high school and college and they start to learn more and become more educated, that they're going to realize these nuances are there. So I don't think it's all bad, and I don't want to be just, you know, laying blame on the film, because I think it does provide an emotional appeal that's going to get young people interested, and hopefully those young people will go out and learn more about it. But like one of the things the film, you know, says, it kind of brings in this idea of a common humanity and a common identity. I mean, it has a picture of the Earth, you know, at the beginning. And you might say, well, that's manipulative. But at the same time, that's often how you get people to connect, is to draw on the universals and not just on the particulars.
Well, but particularly possibly dangerous in any film is to say this is universal and then present only an American Western approach to all the whole problem.
One thing that struck me, I think the very first line of the film is there's video of Gavin Russell being born, and his father, Jason Russell, says every single person in the world started this way. And I'm looking at the, you know, the hospital technology, the video camera going on, and thinking, actually, it's a pretty small fraction of the world who starts the world with this kind of, you know, you know, this set of resources at their disposal. And so that is a double-edged sword that Sophia mentions.
Jan?
I'd like to add a little bit about to what Michael shared about the Ugandan perspective on justice, and to share a story from a woman I respect very much, Angelina Atiam, who is from Lira, Uganda, a midwife whose family became directly affected by the war when her daughter was abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army in 1996, who helped to form an organization of parents working in advocacy to bring the children home, and who has continued to work for justice. She is a woman who has rejected the military campaigns to end the conflict with the Lord's Resistance Army over all of these 20, 25 years that we're talking about. She says she has forgiven him for what he has done, and it's a daily act, something she does in order to protect herself from bitterness, from having her entire life defined by what happened to her and her family. But she also says, I remember the first time she said this to me, I was a bit shocked, but I so understand what she's saying. She said, I don't want Cohn to go to The Hague and have a nice cell with a television. I want him to come back to Uganda and dig in my garden and help my village recover from the destruction of this war. That's what we need. And that's the message I'd like to share with your audience today.
Well, the other part of the call, another question or part of the question was, what should the film have included if it was left out? Or how could it have been made better? Michael Kayemba?
That goes back to that. I mean, the media professor could help with answering this. But in my perspective, they were trying to make this viral. So it would have been extremely hard for them to incorporate the entire story. How could they have done it better? First of all, to get the facts straight that the war is no longer going on in northern Uganda, and that right now Kony's soldiers are not amounting to, what, 300,000 is what the number the film gave, but that they are just a couple hundreds, and that there are concerted efforts by the regional governments to try and end this war, and that that northern Uganda is in a rebuilding process right now. It's no longer at war. So I think getting those facts right at the start alone would have helped the viewers have a more nuanced response.
Michael Palm, what has been the reaction of your students to this video?
Well, I think they, in the conversations I've had with them, they've responded less to the film itself as a media text or a media document and more to its circulation and dissemination as a viral video. And I think that's another part of this story, is what happens when a video like this goes viral and it's not about an adorable cat or a Saturday Night Live skit, but about life and death and about child soldiers. And one of the things that surprised me about their reaction is the the fact that it crossed their Facebook page or their Twitter feed seemed to trigger an almost reflexive skepticism or reluctance in many of them, even or maybe even especially some of them who had immediate emotional reactions to them, that the fact that this was a viral video seemed to indicate almost a reflex in them that there was something more to the story, and a lot of them seemed to be kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop when they initially encountered the video.
It's interesting because go ahead. Yeah, Michael?
And I think that is where I have issue with many of the viewers, especially college students. If in college is where we are supposed to learn critical thought, is where we are supposed to develop our intellectual capacity, I take much issue with college students who become slugtivists. They're like, yes, let's go paint a bridge. Let us go wear corny 2012 videos, even before educating themselves. You know, someone can say that maybe John Russell undermine the intelligence of whoever their audience was by leaving out bits and pieces, then prove him wrong by going and looking for more information and educating yourself before you respond. So, yeah, I think college students, I take much more, I would blame them much more for reacting on impulse.
For those who did react, but it's interesting to hear that there's at least a subset of that group that were skeptical by the very medium that it was transmitted. So we're going to continue this conversation on the state of things, talking about Kony 2012. Michael Palm, Assistant Professor of Communications at UNC. Sophia Swimelar, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Elon. Jan Herman, Program Coordinator at the Center for Reconciliation at Duke. And Michael Kayemba, Ugandan student at UNC. And your phone calls. 877-962-9862. We're going to get to them in this next segment on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about the viral video. Kony 2012 advocates the capture of Joseph Kony, a warlord, first in northern Uganda, now in Central Africa. Michael Palm is here, Assistant Professor of Communications at UNC Chapel Hill. Michael Kayemba is with us, a Ugandan student at UNC. Sophia Swimelar, an Associate Professor of Political Science at Elon. Jan Herman is Program Coordinator of the Center for Reconciliation at the Duke Divinity School. Your phone calls at 877-962-9862, or you can send us an email at sot@wunc.org. I want to listen to another bit of this film and then talk about it in just a second.
In order for Kony to be arrested this year, the Ugandan military has to find him. In order to find him, they need the technology and training to track him in the vast jungle. That's where the American advisors come in. But in order for the American advisors to be there, the U.S. government has to deploy them. They've done that, but if the government doesn't believe the people care about arresting Kony, the mission will be canceled. In order for the people to care, they have to know. And they will only know if Kony's name is everywhere.
So, Sophia, obviously the immediate goal is the capture of Kony, but what are people essentially practically and politically, viewers, being asked to do?
Well, I think they're being asked to do something that's really kind of impractical, right? It's first of all, they're asking to keep the advisors there. There's already a law and already advisors there. They're asking so the law isn't changed, right? It's an odd sort of request that keep it where it's going. As far as I've heard, there's no threat of it being changed. So it's the whole premise is a bit odd that it's about this, the law that Obama signed to have these advisors there. Then you just get into the point about what the advisors can actually do, right? When you look at the capture of war criminals around the world, it's done by domestic forces, right? If you go back to the Balkans, it was the governments there that did that, maybe because of financial incentives. Maybe that's another thing the U.S. could do as opposed to go and actually physically catch him. But the assumption that these advisors are going to go out there and catch him is very, very naive. And they don't necessarily have the mandate to use force. They're supposed to use only self-defense. They're not out there to go and catch him. They're as a supplemental force. And they've already been there. Even in 2008, there was an operation that President Bush supported to try and catch him. So it's a kind of naive thing to base the entire video on these 100 advisors who are going to catch this person. And I think it's unlikely that they would do that. And there's a lot of other means that have been tried in other places to try to catch these guys.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Matt is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hello, Matt.
Hi. My question is kind of what your panel believes the alternative would have been if
the video hadn't been made. It seems if the video has done anything, it has sparked a conversation, and it's, you know, why your guests are there today and why we get to hear from someone from Uganda about what life is like there. It seems if we didn't have the video, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
All right. Well, let's put that question to the panel. Thank you, Matt. Would it be better if the film hadn't been made? Michael Kayemba.
Thank you, Matt. I think it is good that you're saying that the video has sparked a conversation. I think that is important. And I think no one is arguing that the conversation shouldn't be started. But the video has not only started a conversation about LRA, in some circles it has, but this conversation has been going on for 25 years. Mm-hmm. This conversation has not just started. If anything, it has probably amplified it a little bit. But it has also left room for a lot of controversy about the video, about agency of people, about people's stories. So it is important that we are having this so that we do not make mistakes again about in the same nature. Yeah.
But I'd say I agree with Matt that I still think it's good the video is made. I still think it's good the awareness is out there. But now that we're having these conversations about alternatives and nonviolent methods and maybe using financial incentives and all these other things, that is, I think, what was good about this video now is that we're talking about other things that we can do and we're critiquing the video. And we can contact congresspeople and ask them to do other things other than just go out there and catch the guy.
But then the video has also put up a story of what Uganda is like to 100 million
people.
You're
right, people, which is inaccurate.
Which I would rather that was not out there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're right. So,
and we're talking about this one because it went to 100 million, but what about the ones that only go to a million that don't get this attention are equally inaccurate and create these imbalanced pictures?
And the problem is when they are sustained, when they come over and over and over again.
I want to take another phone call right now. Let's go to Raleigh and talk to Rick. Hello, Rick.
Hey, hello.
Yeah, have a question for us?
I agree with Matt. I think the video is a really wonderful video that called our attention to the problem and inspired us to change the problem as any way we could. And I think that sometimes, you know, we can over-intellectualize things. And sometimes in life there is good and there is evil. And sometimes it is good to catch the bad guy. And I just think it's important to keep that in mind.
Well, we've addressed that, and I'm going to get a response to that, Rick. But now that I have you, let me ask you this question. Now that you've heard these other concerns, the fact that that the film may have misrepresented what's really happening in Uganda and presented an unbalanced view of what's going on there, I mean, does that change the way you think about this film? Is it possible
it really
that
doesn't.
Go ahead.
It really doesn't. I think the discussion is good, but it presumes that the video could have been comprehensive and addressed every nuance, every question,
right,
and every interest group, and it can't do that. That wasn't its purpose.
All right, Rick, thank you very much for your call. I don't know if we feel that we've actually addressed that, because I think we're saying, you know, does some good come from this? But if there's anything else, you know, you feel compelled to say.
I would just like to add that if we accept the premise of the caller that this video is a good, then I would definitely like to add that the advice the video gives about what to do with the knowledge people now have that Joseph Kony exists, that this atrocities are being committed, that justice should come, even if it's justice on American terms. The advice about what to do with that knowledge is very weak. It's send us money for a kit.
Right.
And there are so many wonderful things happening on the ground in Uganda that are addressing the long-term consequences of that violence that should be supported by people with resources. And that message is just not there.
I remain fundamentally ambivalent about the video. I'm not prepared to say that I think its dissemination was a good thing. And I think, you know, again, there's the question of the video itself, and then there's the question of its viral dissemination. And you know, the stakes of the caller's question might be what good are 3 million likes on Kony 2012's Facebook page? And I'm not prepared to say that's a bad thing, but I do think that going back to Michael's point about awareness not necessarily equating productive or fruitful ways to think about this project. One, I think we also need to be aware of some of the risks introduced by the ways the video leads us to think. One of those would be to congratulate ourselves for our awareness and to reify some of the differences between us in the West as the good guys or the people with the power to solve their problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I would add that another good thing I think about the video is that it does bring up the ICC. I am a strong proponent of the ICC. I think that it's brought the idea of global justice to the forefront, and it makes it more likely that heads of state and leaders, which we've had for time immemorial, get away with murder, literally. And I think that that's a good thing with mixed strategies, right? So local strategies and reconciliation with the ICC. So if this video is getting people to think about, wow, I never heard of something called the International Criminal Court. What is that? And why is it that the American government doesn't support it at all? Which is a bit ironic that the video asks for American government and people to support sending someone to a court that we don't agree with, that we've tried to sabotage in the past. And so that's a whole other angle that we can take from this video and say, hey, why don't we look into that court? Maybe we should support it. You know, maybe in the end you don't want to, but I think it raises questions about that.
And it also gives us an opportunity to talk about what's really happening on the ground there. Jan, maybe I can talk with you first, then Michael, about what is going on in the mm-hmm. aftermath of this violence.
What has been going on in the last several years, since the LRA left Uganda, which was in 2006, is that a number of agencies, including the government, both national and district and local governments, as well as a number of community-based organizations and faith-based organizations, have been tackling the immense problem of trying to rebuild entire villages and towns that were affected by the war. At the height of the violence, 1.8 million people were receiving food aid because they had not been able to do their farming because of the war. So just to recover farmland, to recover schools, to rebuild clinics, those are some of the things that are going on. And there's a small organization that I really love called the Concerned Children and Youth Association, based in Lira. And they have been mentored by Mama Angelina Atiam, whom I mentioned earlier, and they are formerly abducted children, youth who've returned from the LRA or were orphaned by the war or grew up in those camps and are part of the hunger for reconciliation and redevelopment in northern Uganda. They're wonderful people to support. They are trying to help young people learn how to raise bees, to farm using more modern techniques. They're also supporting children disabled because of the war through education. They're trying to learn themselves how to be better advocates for children and youth in northern Uganda. They're one of many examples of really wonderful Ugandan-led organizations.
And they have a blog, I believe.
They have a blog and a website,
film,
yes.
Or a number of yes. their members. Can you characterize some of the responses? In a sense, how have they seen this film, or are they're pretty mixed?
Yes, the responses are mixed. I've been following their blog a bit, and they're echoing some of the things Michael has said. Why weren't we talked to about what's happening now? It's not a military operation that we need now. We need support to recover from the years when there were no schools, as just one example. And so they're saying the military budget is still a priority in the national government, and it could be better used, redirected to the north, to all parts of Uganda, but especially to the north, which has lost so much. So, yes, they're receiving comments like on the blog. There are comments like the callers, but isn't publicity good? And they're saying, mm-hmm. we're happy that the rest of the world knows what we've been suffering for so long, but we would like to engage with you. So,
Michael Campbell, what's your sense of what are the political priorities and social priorities these days in Uganda?
As far as northern Uganda is concerned, I think right now the government's priority is to rebuild and reset to the people. And I think there has been some good ground that's been covered. I think one of the measures of political will, at least the government put aside a dedicated ministry for northern Uganda recovery and there is a minister that's responsible for that. And Northern Uganda, historically, even during the period of the war, is a very agriculturally resourceful area, and people had farmland, and people, during the time when there was a lot of hunger, it's because people could not go onto their farmland. So now people are being taken back onto their farmland to try and cultivate crops, to get back in touch with nature, and also to send their children to school, rebuilding schools, as well as the reconciliation and justice commissions are also going on. But to what you hinted at, in terms of the priorities of the government, yeah, many people could argue that some priorities are probably still misaligned, that it made sense when we were still fighting coactively from 2000 to 2005 for the defense budget to be large. And that made sense. But now that the conflict is done and it's more rehabilitation, there needs to be more of a redistribution of that. And I think those are areas that the Ugandan government needs to work on and actively get there.
And again, these are things that you can actually study and follow. There are great international journals that you can actually spend time understanding the political and social realities in that country. But it does lead us, I think, back to these questions about what happens when these videos go viral. How about just the whole notion of social activism? Can we take heart that even if some subset of the viewers believe that it's all misguided, a bunch of people got active and not particularly on this issue, but they are willing to take part and look at the rest of the world and act, do something, even if it's put on a T-shirt?
I think there's a fundamental question between breadth and depth that was really highlighted by this video as a piece of media activism, and also its dissemination as part of that activism. And I think the challenge moving forward is to find both and ways to incorporate online and offline activism. And, you know, last year in some of the insurrections in North Africa provide very encouraging, empowering examples where many of the same types of social media were used to both mobilize large groups of people for on-the-ground demonstrations and then also to publicize either violent crackdowns of the demonstrations or to deal with some of the fallout of the clashes between the dictators and the governments and the people on the ground. And I think that's also part of the dis-ease that people have with this video in terms of the way that it kind of, both in its choice of target and in its forms of mobilization, do reflect but also distort some of the activism that we saw in 2011 in North Africa.
Sophia?
Yeah, people have compared it to the Arab Spring and the use of social media. But as you kind of were hinting at there, it's a very big difference when it's the people themselves using the social media than a whole group of other people on behalf of someone else quite far away using social media. So I don't think that those parallels that we've heard people making are completely accurate. But it's pretty remarkable that a non-state actor, an NGO like Invisible Children, can get the U.S. Congress to, within a week or two, pass a bipartisan resolution, which is quite hard to do these days, 37 senators standing up. And they said, my daughter came to me and said, what are you going to do about this Coney guy, right? And you have quotes from Senator McCain talking about how powerful it is and how if 100 million people are talking about it, we must do something. So it really does show the power in the 21st century that non-state actors have to get their states to do something. Now, whether they're doing something that we like or is the correct thing is another argument or topic altogether.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Sophia Swimelaar is an assistant professor of political science and coordinator of the Nonviolent Studies Program at Elon University. Jan Herman, program coordinator of the Center for Reconciliation at Duke Divinity School. Michael Kayemba is a Ugandan student from UNC Chapel Hill. Michael Palm is an assistant professor of communication studies in the Concentration of Media Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.